All right, and we're back with Emma Thompson, The Good, the Bad, and the Crazy, Part 2. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Now, Sean, I've been thinking a little bit about the movie that we're about to discuss, and I believe I have realized two things. I have a feeling that this is the film that most people in the world will have watched of any of the movies we've ever done.
What about Sister Act?
Sister Act, yes, but I have to say, this movie, by virtue of its sinister and cynical inclusion as a Christmas perennial, has probably been viewed by more people around the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a staple of the ITV network every Christmas, at least twice.
It's probably also shown on, you know, the Prince Charles here in London on their Christmas family money-grubbing programming.
I can see this being screened in Clapham somewhere.
Yes, this is such a Clapham movie.
Need I say any more? I don't think so.
Well, and I would also posit to you, Sean, that this film is the most reprehensible of any movie we've ever covered.
This is one of those instances where, during the screening of our film, I vocalized how much I fucking hated it as we were watching it. Every so often I'd be like, oh my god, is there an hour left of this piece of shit?
The film, of course, ladies and gentlemen, if you can't tell from the tone of our voice, is that holiday classic, Love Actually.
Now, Brian, I want to know why I didn't hate this so much when I saw it aged 14 in 2003.
Didn't you hate it? Because I have to say, okay, so ladies and gentlemen, I have no idea how many of you fondly remember it as a Christmas classic, but I am going to go on the record and say I have hated this film since it first hit my eyeballs. This is not a situation of, like, woke revisionism where, like, I've read some articles on Jezebel and I've now decided it's terrible. I vividly remember being a young person in New York City, realizing there was a big holiday movie coming out that had Emma Thompson in the, you know, newspaper ads, and going to see it, yes, by myself in the East Village, one wintry New York afternoon, and walking out of the cinema spitting, angrily stomping the floor, ready to moan, bitch, and complain that this movie was a misogynistic piece of shit.
Well, good for you for being on the right side of history, Brian. And I knew you were against the Iraq War just as much as you hated this film in 2003.
Yes, and the Iraq War will come up in a moment as we talk about the political aspect of this film. But I want to know, Sean, what is your past experience with Love Actually?
Well, I remember I saw it in Longford Cinema with my sister and my mother. Might I add, well after Christmas. Might have been early New Year we saw this. Like, because the moment a Christmas film enters into the next year, it suddenly just becomes untouchable. Like, you should not go near it.
What did you and your mother and your sister have any memorable responses to it?
I think we were looking for something that was silly and stupid, and we definitely got it. It was, what else are you going to do in Longford in, you know, it's January 2nd? But you come out of it thinking about the things you liked about it, and Emma Thompson is obviously one of them. I do remember at the time thinking that the Laura Linney story was deeply unpleasant and not fair, and why does she not get her true happy ending? She gets a kind of a happy ending, doesn't she?
Sort no, of. Not what? At all, doesn't and she, we can deal with
doesn't
that.
Doesn't she make out with the guy?
No.
Oh, she doesn't make out
Sean,
with
we
him.
Just saw the movie.
Oh, right, okay. You know, let's have a little bit of revisionism. I probably hated it.
I didn't hate it
as much as I hated it tonight.
You probably hated it? I mean, did it leave any impression on you at all? Did you and your mum and your sister have any conversation about, like, structural feminism?
Well, we talked about how awful the Laura Linney story was.
Uh-huh.
And how unpleasant it was. We all felt for poor Emma. And we probably all said the men were awful, but we didn't, you know, go home and get out our muskets like we should have done.
Okay. So, of course, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to dive into this film in detail with particular focus on Emma's plotline. I just want to say this film was written and directed by Richard Curtis, who Emma has worked with before, and indeed the whole cast of this movie includes a lot of people who you could say are in the kind of British you know, stars of the day pantheon.
Yeah, they're British stars, and actually some stars of the future.
Stars of the future, stars of the past, also two of the stars of the last film we did, so...
Weird. Here, three, in fact.
Well, but this is the thing, it's actually not that weird. It's this kind of clubbiness of British cinema, which I think... Emma is definitely open to, right? In some ways, if you were to watch all her movies in a row, you'd see a few people again and again. You'd see Anthony Hopkins, you'd see Hugh Grant, you'd see Alan Rickman.
All her Footlights friends.
Yeah, it's all this kind of Cambridge Footlights, Imelda Staunton, Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry. They're all in there. You know, they're often working with people like Richard Curtis, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, blah, 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 blah. So it does have this slightly, like, lovey quality. This is a word that I've learned since I've come to Britain, and it's a very useful word to describe a certain kind of thespian.
Yeah, lovey, L-U-V-V-I-E. Sounds like a nice word, doesn't it? But a lovey is kind of like this, oh, darling, oh, yes, oh, yes, and that kind of type.
They all sort of went to Oxbridge and studied at RADA.
And they're also well-meaning and sincere,
a lot
dignified.
Of them get knighted, maybe, and damed later on.
Lovies.
Yeah. So here is Richard Curtis, impresario of the British rom-com renaissance, begun by Four Weddings and a Funeral.
He's taking the helm of this one.
Right. Now, Sean, what is your past experience with the Richard Curtis type of rom-com? Do you like them?
Well, you've never seen Notting Hill.
No.
And I think we should reserve that for a future episode of Broad Appeal. That is a very good Richard Curtis rom-com. It's also not directed by him, and I'm quite a fan of that. I think it's an interesting take on the traditions of the rom-com by reversing the male-female heroine roles. And sometimes, actually, that's all you need to make a romantic comedy interesting, especially a British one.
Yeah, you just need a kind of a new twist, because a romantic comedy is going to basically follow much of the same outline. We've talked about this in the past.
It's a genre picture.
Yeah. Four Weddings and a Funeral, I think, is a truly delightful film that, Andy McDowell and all, it has these colorful characters, it has highs and lows, moments of hilarity. Hugh Grant is absolutely charming. So, what is it, then, about Love Actually that just makes us want to puke? I mean, number one, it is a romantic comedy, what, like 15? I mean, how many plot lines are there in this?
I think there are about 12.
Yeah. There's an overabundance of plot lines.
Yeah.
And it's all set at, honestly, my least favorite time of year.
You know, it's funny, least favorite is actually just most hated, isn't it?
It is. Am I just being a grump, a grouch, a Scrooge here by saying that I hate Christmas, and this movie is not even about the good parts of Christmas. It's literally about everything that's bad about Christmas.
Yeah, well, you hate Christmas, and you are a grouse, and you are a grump, and you're a real curmudgeon, so let's just put that out there. But I don't think you're wrong for hating Christmas.
Things I hate about Christmas are not time with the family, they're not charitable giving, they're not cozy nights around the fire and family. All things that are nowhere to be seen in this film, right? The things I hate about Christmas are forced socializing on a hectic scale, being overstressed with work. Both of these things occur in the film, yeah? I hate, especially in this country, having to go out with office drinks with annoying people who get completely trashed.
Uh-huh.
I hate the stress and pressure of buying the right Christmas presents for people and all the commercialism. Another major feature of this movie. I hate this kind of British obsession with, like, which number one single is going to be on at Christmas? Like, why is Christmas such a special freaking day? Like, can't we just say, okay, great, it's the end of the year, it's a day off, we're just gonna, like, sit around and enjoy ourselves? Why does it have to have all these pointless rituals? Which is basically what Love Actually is entirely about. Pointless rituals.
God, that was long. That was a diatribe, wasn't it? I forgot that I was even here.
Okay, so do you hate Christmas?
I think actually having Thanksgiving before Christmas takes the onus on making it such a freaking extreme holiday. You know what I mean?
Thanksgiving is a beautiful holiday. It's far superior.
Yeah, but what I'm saying here is that you get a holiday before Christmas, which dilutes the significance of Christmas. Because the British here don't celebrate Halloween as the pagan festival that my country does, you put all this extra pressure on Christmas for all the days off you get and all the meaning and significance. But like you said, it's not about like family time or connecting with people. It's about the shopping, the work dues, the, I'm guessing, traffic and going home.
And the alcohol consumption.
Yeah, and sitting in the vestibule on the Virgin trains so you can't get a seat.
You know, more praise out there for Jodie Foster, the only cinematic auteur who has ever devoted an entire film to the beauty of Thanksgiving. Home for the holidays. Watch it.
Yeah.
Okay, but back to Love Actually. Number one, it's a Christmas movie, but a soulless one.
Well,
yeah?
Can I also point out, we're talking about what makes it so bad. Yeah, it has too many people in it. If it was a traditional rom-com that removed Christmas and focused on only a few people, it wouldn't just feel like some cynical ploy to like tie up all these poorly formed ideas into one cancerous cell of a picture.
Well, it is. Yeah, that cancer metaphor is a good one because it keeps multiplying. It keeps spreading. I mean, why do these people have to be interrelated at all? Why couldn't it just be 12 Stories of Londoners? Instead, we have to have this weird thing where, like, both Colin Firth and Laura Linney are at Chiwetel Ejiofor and Keira Knightley's wedding, but there's never any explanation for, like, how they know them or how close they are as friends. It's just so that we can then follow everybody off in their own story and be like, oh, she's his boss, she's her next-door neighbor. I could get over all that contrivance, yeah,
okay,
I suppose.
You could, yeah? I find it very difficult to get over.
Sure, but you can accept it, yeah? If the film were funnier, number one,
mm-hmm,
even that, you still might be like, oh, it's cute. Because let's be honest, we didn't have a barrel of laughs when we rewatched Sister Act, you know.
We liked it, though.
We did. So here's the elephant in the room. Here's the big lump of coal in this Christmas stocking. It begins with an M. It's not the word Mary, it's the word misogyny.
Yeah, it's a deeply misogynist film, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist who is also a feminist to realize this.
But apparently it does, because I think in recent years there have been a lot of internet evaluations of this movie that have been spread around. It's completely validated my own instinctual response to it. But there are still plenty of people who sit down with the fam, watch Love Actually, happily remember Love Actually. Many of the, you know, set piece scenes have become iconic of this film. Why is it that a movie which at its core is fundamentally about middle-aged men having sexual crises and actually, frankly, workplace harassment and assault, why is this movie not more roundly criticized?
Well, I'm going to answer that question in two parts, Brian, okay? I'm going to start about why don't people realize this, and increasingly in years people have. And this is one of the few instances where I think the internet has actually just been good for society. There's been a great pluralism in film criticism. It's given people the opportunity to say, hey, listen, I might be wrong here, but isn't this piece of shit for X, Y, and Z reasons? And someone else will say, oh my god, I've always thought that too. I mean, this is just a simple example, you know? So, kind of, Twitter plurality has helped in reevaluating what we consider to be harmless entertainment as, you know, narrow-minded, basic crap. Which is what Love Actually is.
And it's perpetuating these dreadful ideas. It's been really weird, actually, frankly, watching this movie now. As I've said, I've always hated it. But watching it now in the immediately post-Weinstein era, because you were saying, I'm not sure half of these plot lines would survive the script editor this time around,
yeah,
in 2017.
And it's not because people's sense of humor has gotten worse. In fact, people's sense of humor has gotten so much better, as far as I'm concerned. Who's that guy, the one who's in My Family, he's at the very start of it, he's the caterer?
Chris Marshall.
Okay, so Chris Marshall just wanders up to women and says, like, hello, future wife, and he's just like the mail boy or something. If any woman was spoken to, any woman, you know, is established worker in a company with some, like, numbskull coming up to them and say, anyone in fact, but some numbskull coming up and saying that to them, it's just like, fuck off, will you?
Well, and in fact, those women do basically say that to him.
Yeah, but they don't say it in as many words.
Well, yeah, and his conclusion in, you know, probably the most ridiculous plotline in the film, his conclusion is that all English girls are quote-unquote stuck up,
yeah,
and he has to go to America.
Yeah, because all American girls will fall for any idiot with a British accent.
I'm going to America.
Colin,
You're a lonely, ugly arsehole, and you must accept it.
Never. I am Colin, god of sex. I'm just on the wrong continent, that's all.
There's a bit of a funny sketch, I suppose, in that joke. But here's the thing, and that it's interesting that you pick him as the first man in the movie we talk about, because it's emblematic of all the men in the film, right? They are losers, they make bad choices, they're reprehensible in lots of different ways, with the exception, possibly, of Liam Neeson.
And also, actually, what's his name? Martin Freeman is actually a nice guy.
Martin Freeman, very nice, very consensual. And Bill Nighy is, you know, off on another planet. So there's a few who don't fall into this rubric. But most of the men in this movie...
Yeah, more than less of them.
Yeah, they're terrible, unattractive, unappealing, sleazy men, which is fine. Such men definitely do exist in the world.
Gay and straight.
And... narratively, they are all rewarded for their terrible behavior in one way or another throughout the film.
Let's go through a few of them and then let's try and choose our worst one, will we?
I used to think I knew which were the most repellent plot lines in the movie, but I'm now reevaluating and I'm very interested to know from you which ones made your skin crawl the most.
Okay, so we have, what's his name?
Chris Marshall.
Yeah, Chris Marshall.
The horny sandwich delivery man who goes off to America.
Then we have Andrew Lincoln, who is best friends, ostensibly best friends with Chiwetel, who's got married to Keira Knightley. He is rude to Keira Knightley every time he speaks to her, okay? Because he's in love with her, okay? Well, he's a grown man.
Here's the thing, and this is stretched out because at first the implication is, oh, he's really in love with Chiwetel.
That's actually something I liked.
Of course, there's actually quite a lot of gay panic and transphobic jokes that get mentioned.
To. Yeah.
No, but honestly, this is mentioned in the wedding scene
where
Chiwetel says, you haven't made any crazy surprise plans here at the wedding, have you? Like those prostitutes that you got at the bachelor party, it would have been a lot better if they hadn't turned out to be men.
Yeah.
Ha ha.
I just think that if you want to be funny about something, there's no point in just taunting other people or making jokes about a whole group of society that you have nothing to deal with. If their punchline is that those women are actually men, like, listen, we all love Drag Race and we can all make those kind of jokes, okay? But it's just like when it's at the expense of someone by... someone's stupid. I just don't care.
Well, and someone who's not even a character in the film. But I think what makes it even worse is that this is happening while Chiwetel is there on the altar waiting for Keira Knightley to come in.
Yeah, it's like, is this really the place for a trans joke? It just doesn't feel like it should be.
To take up your point about the way that that little plotline is stretched out, Richard Curtis has so many plot lines to deal with that actually some of them barely have an arc. They're just a little, like, you know, tiny arc. And so he has to stretch them out. So it's like, okay, well, we're not going to reveal that Andrew Lincoln's actually in love with Keira Knightley. So it's going to sort of seem like he's in love with Chiwetel. Then it's going to seem that he's just upset that he's lost his friend. But no, actually, he's in love with Keira Knightley to a degree that is weird and stalkerish and obsessive.
Yeah.
Keira Knightley shows up in that terrible outfit with that hat and the banoffee tie.
I keep saying this to you, babe, during the screening of it. It was the early 2000s and it is not their fault, okay? Fashion was just a wasteland.
Which would you rather wear? The outfits that Keira Knightley wears in this film or the Empire Waist gowns of Jane Austen?
I would rather wear the Empire Waist gowns.
Thank you.
But I'm just saying it's not their fault.
That
it's
is
just
the correct answer.
It's period costuming. But the thing about this particular subplot that really creeps me out as well, you know, if, for example, he was actually best friends with Keira Knightley, imagine if they were just girl-boy best friends, and she found that the video of her wedding was all her, filmed by her best friend, okay, which he has this relationship with, it just wouldn't have the same creepiness as the guy who can barely utter a full sentence to her without sounding like a total, like, weird dick to her.
Well, so the thing is...
that's not cute.
Nominally, he's in love with her, but he presents this love by being incredibly standoffish and angry to her, to her face, because she's chosen his best friend. And then, in private, he, like, weirdly, creepily photographs her and obsessively watches her like a fucking religious icon on a VHS tape. Okay, that's weird and stalkerish enough, and she does seem legitimately weirded out by this. Not enough, apparently, to talk to Chiwetel about it, okay? And then one night, in the conclusion, the amazing conclusion of this plot, who shows up at Andrew Lincoln at the door with this, you know, ridiculous gimmicky thing with the signs and the boombox and the carols to basically say, I know you're with my best friend, I'm gonna love you until the day I die, and be a sort of weird stalkerish loser. And how does Keira Knightley respond to this insane behavior?
Well, she responds with open arms and, like, more than just a peck.
Before that, she just giggles. This is the thing. She's barely given any line. You know, Chiwetel's nowhere to be seen. So yeah. He's not given any character. He's completely emasculated by just being this, like, man upstairs in bed. She's not even allowed to respond to this guy's insane gesture other than by giggling. And he walks away, and then she runs after him to give him a kiss.
And bear in mind, he also reveals this to her with cue cards. Like, he can't articulate anything to her using words.
And you notice that they're also cue cards that have, like, the pictures of a wizened old crone and a lot of hot babes on them.
I mean, she's not so much a wizened old crone as she is, like, a fossilized mummy.
The men in this movie are attempting to, through humor, right, be like, oh, I understand what a loser I am, but look how funny, yeah? I'm going to say, actually, that the Keira Knightley, Andrew Lincoln plot is the worst in the whole movie. I didn't always think this. I am trapped in a marriage where my husband's best friend behaves this way and wants me to keep it a secret, and the narrative of the plot, like, forces me to kiss him on the street. Men do not, they don't realize the degree to which this is, like, oppressive behavior. It is not cute behavior.
So, Brian, you're putting your cards on the table. That is by far the most reprehensible one for you.
What are the other plot lines in the film?
Okay, so we have Colin Firth, who is a man. I don't know what anyone does in this thing.
I think he writes crime fiction.
Well, I don't know if that's his job, or if it's a hobby, or if it's anything, okay? It's just something that he does in Provence. So he's a man who goes to his wedding, and his girlfriend is snotty and ill and is left at home. He kisses her, tells her he loves her, and then goes to the wedding. Comes back to find his brother there, to which we hear from the bedroom, I'm waiting for you, big boy. I'm naked, and I want you at least twice before James gets home. The cuck then moves to Provence, where he writes his book. Okay, what happens then?
Yeah, he's apparently come to Provence in the past, but this time he's been set up with a housekeeper who, while he speaks passable French, this housekeeper, who's young and beautiful and named Aurelia, only speaks Portuguese. So they can barely communicate except for these hilarious, you know, mis-exchanges in English and Portuguese. But, of course, they're slowly falling in love.
Yeah, which I find really hard to believe. Okay, I know you gotta suspend your disbelief, but, like, there's no spark between these two people. There's nothing there. There's nothing.
The spark is that she's incredibly gorgeous, and at one point, when he is stupidly working on his manuscript on a windy day by a dock near a pond...
In December. It doesn't matter if it's Provence.
Yeah, I know. It's still cold in Provence in December. So she lifts his paperweight and all his pages go flying into the pond. Now, this is a film from the 21st century, so why he's working with a typewriter and, you know, single copies of manuscript-typed pages is probably a bridge too far to ask a question. But what does she do once all the papers have floated into the pond?
So she rushes to the pond, strips off all her, well, most of her clothes, and dives in to get them.
Because wet paper is so valuable, and she wants to take the time to strip down to her bra and panties before jumping into the water.
Yeah, and 5 salvaged wet pieces of paper will really make up for the accident that just happened, won't it?
In this moment, as she's stripping off, this is where you see the leering gaze of the camera, which is implicitly the leering gaze of repressed Englishman Colin Firth being like, oh, this housekeeper, look at her gorgeous fucking body. You know, it's moments like that you're like, okay, he is basically still her employer. She is nervous that she might get fired because she's just inadvertently destroyed his fucking manuscript. But now, of course, they're going to fall in love, even though the power differential between them is so enormous.
Yes. Okay, I'm not gonna decide until it's over which my least favorite one is, or most hated. That's up there.
Io sai che sei loco, perché mal ti conosco. Ma às vezes as coisas são muito claras para mim. Por... Não preciso de prova.
Can we talk about quickly widower Liam Neeson and the lessons that he offers to his young, lovelorn son?
Yeah, quickly, because I do hate this one, but not because it's reprehensible, just because it's crap.
It's just wet, isn't it? Yeah. And it is sad because at this time in real life, Liam Neeson was not a widower, but he would be later.
Yeah, that was genuinely sad, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, basically, his wife has died, he's left with the kid is in love with a girl at school who doesn't pay attention to him.
So instead of asking his son to talk to the girl, they concoct this bullshit plan for him to be a drummer in the school play.
Yeah, because that's going to get her attention. And then, of course, he encourages his son to break the law and run through Heathrow Airport in danger of, like, being shot by the TSA guards, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the little boy who's going to grow up to be one of these other reprehensible British men, he is rewarded for this insane behavior, but yet again, an affectionate kiss from the girl after he's run through the airport.
Yeah, after he's put the whole airport into lockdown and has been shot dead several times, you know, he finally is rewarded with his kiss.
Okay, you know what I'm interested, though, in pointing out, which is a kind of running theme throughout all this, is men not being able to talk to women.
Well, that is true to life, at least.
Well,
isn't
maybe
it?
It's true to life. In this film, they are all rewarded for their inability to speak, right? Like, Colin Firth can't speak because he doesn't know the language. The boy isn't encouraged by his dad to speak. Andrew Lincoln
just can't speak at all.
He can only talk through his creepy videos and his creepy cue cards. It's like, is there any mature man in this film who can just tell a woman that he loves her? Actually, it's Martin Freeman.
Yes, it is, actually. Now, I should point out that while he is not reprehensible, I don't like their storyline much either.
What are they even doing?
I don't know what they're doing, because I was also thinking, no film from the early 2000s would have this long, like, no real film from the early 2000s would have sex scenes this long and plentiful.
And also, they're filming it over 4 weeks.
Yeah, so they're body doubles, naked body doubles for some sex scene in some movie. He's very friendly and all the kind of stuff. But what I don't like about it is, I'm sure the actors on set are actually quite nice, but the fact that it's written into it, where they're like, okay, can you cup the breasts and massage them, please? And more thrusting, and nipples down. And it's kind of like, chuckle, chuckle, embarrassing, eh, sort of.
Well, I guess the humor is that they're chatting about relatively banal things while they're in this physical intimacy.
Yeah, I get that. I do get that. I just don't think that's, like, really particularly funny either.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, I had forgotten the amount of nude female breasts that appear throughout this film.
There's so many breasts.
There's that girl's actual breasts.
Yeah, there's Laura Linney's actual breasts.
And then there's also this kind of art exhibit of naked-breasted women that we keep returning to, including at one office Christmas party.
Remember, page 3 was still alive and kicking at this point.
Yes.
Isn't it kind of crazy that you'd open, you'd buy a newspaper, you'd turn the page, and there is a topless young woman?
It's outrageous.
I mean,
but this is a Christmas movie, and it has the same shit.
It does, yeah. It's like there's an office Christmas party, and there's just this giant pair of tits, like blown up.
All right, so we've whizzed through most of the plots that I can remember, but now we've gotten down to the kind of core group of people who are in this movie, okay? So we have Emma Thompson, who is nominally the subject of this episode, her husband Alan Rickman, who runs an office where Laura Linney works.
Yes.
And then we also have Emma's brother, Hugh Grant, who just so happens to be the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Uh-huh.
Now, maybe we should take the political one first?
Yeah, let's whiz through this one. Hugh Grant is the Prime Minister. He meets his staff on what appears to be the very first day he enters office. One of them is Martine McCutcheon.
Point of information, who is Martine McCutcheon?
Martine McCutcheon was on EastEnders. Don't ask me who she played, because I couldn't tell you. But she also had a very mediocre, short-lived, but memorable music career. Perfect moment, anyone? And she also, short-lived, but probably unmemorable to the woman who got married, was Liza Minnelli's bridesmaid as well.
Wait, what? In her marriage to David Guest?
Yeah.
Oh, Liza. Yeah. So, Martine McCutcheon plays...
If you look at her wedding photos, it's her, Liz Taylor, Michael Jackson, And Martine McCutcheon.
That's amazing. So she plays this girl called Natalie, who's like an underling at number 10 Downing Street. She basically delivers the tea. What is the running gag about Natalie?
Oh, that she puts her foot in it and she has a blue mouth.
Yeah, there's another running gag that actually runs further through the film.
Oh, that she's chunky or something.
Yeah, she's referred to as chubby, plumpy. Another female staffer at one point tells Hugh Grant she has a sizable arse and enormous thighs.
Yeah, I didn't like that at all.
Honestly, like, the fat-shaming jokes are rife. But basically, Hugh is a single sort of attractive young prime minister who shows up into office, yeah? Uh-huh. And immediately upon realizing that the tea woman who's going to be delivering him tea all the time is this, you know, attractive staffer, he says to himself, that's going to be inconvenient. You know, this film is from the early 2000s. Of course, in our mind, we have all the real-life political figures. We have Bill Clinton. We have Monica Lewinsky on our mind. We have Tony Blair and George Bush on our mind. And the movie is wanting us to relate the fictional Hugh Grant premiership to all this real political dynamic. Uh-huh. So we're supposed to like him as the British Prime Minister because even though he's feeling stirrings for his employee, he doesn't act on them. But who comes along but the Yahoo President of the United States, Billy Bob Thornton, who is like a sort of weird combination of Clinton and W together,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
You want to say something about that?
Well, in the sense that he's kind of this cowboy president who also is a total skis, essentially.
Yeah, upon seeing Martine McCutcheon, he's like examining her ass and saying what a nice set of pipes she has.
Yeah, and actually, just to show you how they have to compress every plot line into like mere moments. Minutes later, she goes to bring in biscuits and he's like touching her up, okay? It's just that fast.
And can we just say, so basically, Hugh Grant comes in on them in the middle of this kind of strange embrace. He doesn't pause to ask, you know, what's going on, or ask his employee whether it's consensual or anything. Instead, he jumps to the conclusion, oh, she must have enjoyed this, you know, getting felt up in the workplace by the most powerful man in the Western world.
Yeah, she clearly prefers the Americans over the British.
Yeah, and so then he goes off and gives this news conference in which he talks about the special relationship and how the thing about friendship between nations is that one shouldn't bully another.
We may be a small country, but we're a great one too. The country of Shakespeare, Churchill, the Beatles, Sean Connery, Harry Potter, David Beckham's right foot, David Beckham's left foot, come to that. And a friend who bullies us is no longer a friend. And since bullies only respond to strength, from now onward, I will be prepared to be much stronger. And the president should be prepared for that.
Now, I have to say that when the movie came out, I don't know if you remember this, Sean, but, like, we were right in the midst of the Bush-Blair years and the Iraq War, where the perception was that America was really bullying Britain around into joining wars and following their agenda. So that Hugh Grant speech, like, really brought down the house for a lot of people. What I think really makes it hollow is two things. Number one, the political disagreements between President Billy Bob Thornton and Prime Minister Tony Blair, they don't even say what they're about. Like, there's literally half a scene where Billy Bob says things like, I don't think these policies are the kind of policies that I would agree with. You should change your policies. And it's like, well, what could we even, like, have a word like war or economics? Like, could we even talk about whatever it is we're talking about?
Well, here's the thing. They made the effort by giving him the job of prime minister, so at least we know what he does, okay? And that's enough.
And then the other thing that makes that speech ring hollow is that he's just seen his beloved underling being felt up by the president. So it's like, oh, is he just like calling out the United States because he feels jilted in love? Well, you know, his ratings go up because he's stood up to the USA. And then later on, he has to transfer Natalie to another, you know, office or something. And she sends him a Christmas card that basically says, I know what it looked like, but, quote, I'm yours, actually, and I always have been, ugh. Natalie. Now, this is just inappropriate behavior for any kind of employee-boss relationship, but particularly when one of them is, you know, the Prime Minister.
Yeah, the person in the country with the most power.
So then, of course, he goes running down to Wandsworth, he finds her, and they end up at the Christmas pageant together, and they make out, and it's all great.
Yeah, where he also bumps into his sister, who's Emma Thompson.
Yeah, but at no point does Hugh Grant ever say, you know, oh, maybe we should report the president's behavior to our HR people, or, like,
would that have been a great line?
Did you feel traumatized by his, you know, non-consensual groping of you?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that I didn't stand up and talk about it at the time.
Well, that's the only thing that, if we're going to talk about what could have been done differently in that, it's the fact that a man in power looks at a woman not in power being touched up by a man who has ultimate power and somehow thinks that they're both on equal footing.
And also think that it's all about him and his own attraction to her.
Exactly.
Ugh.
Oh, so stupid.
Okay, we are going to get to Emma Thompson, please. But we have to... Well, we've not talked about Laura Linney.
Oh, God, this is the saddest one of all.
And I have to say that when I first saw it, this is the part of the film that enraged me. Quick headline of what this is about. Laura Linney is a very friendly, very nice woman in an agency of some sort run by Alan Rickman. It's never clear what anyone really does for a job in this film, but it's some kind of creative agency or company. And she's introduced when Alan Rickman takes her into his office and says, "You're in love with Carl, aren't you?" And she's like, "Oh my God, like, have you really realized it?" And of course, Carl is this beautiful man who also works in the office, and everyone in the office knows that they have an attraction to each other, so why haven't they gotten together? Well, you're not really sure for a few scenes. We keep seeing Laura Linney. Her phone keeps going off. She seems a bit mousy, but she's, you know, perfectly nice. She stays late at the office. She's pining for Carl. She's putting on lipstick. They're not talking to each other. You think, oh, this is going to be some touching thing where these two shy people find each other. But no, because Laura Linney has one impediment, an impediment that, you know, everyone will tell you, if you have this impediment, it means you will never be able to have sex with anyone. What is that impediment, Sean?
She has a brother who appears to be in institutionalized care. For
right.
What? We're not quite sure.
Right.
But he's not well.
So even if you're a perfectly attractive, lovely, well-adjusted woman with a job, you cannot have sex with your coworker because your brother is in institutionalized care. Now, how on earth does any of this make sense?
Well, it doesn't.
Do you want to just describe the excruciating scene after the Christmas party where hunky Carl... Why is a Brazilian named Carl? I'm not sure. If his name had been, like, you know, Edilson or, like, you know...
That's the only Brazilian
Jefferson,
name you know, isn't
Jefferson?
It? Jefferson?
If his name had been that, it would have been more believable. But his name is Carl. So he comes home and they, you know, smooch on the doorstep. She takes him up to her room. And then this long, excruciating, uninterrupted shot... I mean, it's not excruciating to look at Rodrigo Santoro, who, like, while working in this nameless company, has the body and oiled-up skin of a, like, underwear model.
Actually, he's got one of those bodies that I really love. It's what I would call the surprise body.
I mean, he looks, with his suit on, like a kind of second-rate Gael Garcia Bernal, but when the clothes come off, I mean, he's like,
woo!
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're starting to make out, and you're like, oh, thank goodness mousy Laura Linney is going to get a bit of action.
Yeah, until her phone rings, and it's her brother. Then he rings again, just as, like, he's on top of her or something. And she's like, oh, well, of course I can come right now. And it's kind of like, ugh!
I'm not even sure this is good behavior for someone who's in institutionalized care.
Because you shouldn't assume that you can rely on someone to come day or night. Because that's just not how getting better works.
In the middle of the night on what's presumably like a Saturday night when she's just come home from a Christmas party, it's gotta be like 2 a.m.
Yeah.
He's calling her. Why does he have access to a phone at this time?
Yeah, what ward would actually let her in?
Aren't there staff members who are able to deal with him? Why does she think it's good behavior that she's going to come at any hour of the night? Yeah, answer the phone maybe, but, like, come and visit him? Very confusing.
It's like, so what's happening with the writing of this film is they've decided to just never allow her to be happy, ever.
And, of course, she's not happy. And also, Rodrigo Santoro, while incredibly hot, is apparently not smart enough to think to himself, oh, actually, if I'm attracted to this woman and, like, we want to have a serious relationship, I could possibly deal with the fact that she has a family and has a life outside of having sex with me.
I could ask her a question about it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you kind of want to say to Laura Linney, if this guy can't deal with the fact that you sometimes get calls from your brother, then maybe he's a shitty boyfriend or would be a shitty boyfriend anyway.
Agreed.
You said that the problem is that the narrative of the film doesn't want her to have sex. I'd say that Richard Curtis has decided, oh, I'm going to show the whole pantheon of human emotions, right? I'm going to have everything from the completely ridiculous, like the porn actors and the British accent in America. That's completely absurd. I'm going to have kind of romantic stuff like the whole Portuguese plotline.
And the Andrew Lincoln thing, which a lot of people are supposed to think is romantic.
Yeah. So there's all that. And then he's like, and I'm also going to put in some sad bits. Because that really worked for me so well in Four Weddings and a Funeral, yeah? So I'm going to have people who, you know, life doesn't really work out the way they expect, like Laura Linney, but at least she has her brother as her family. And I'm also going to put in the story of a marriage.
And this is where we finally get to Emma's plotline.
I know. I'm sorry it's taken us so long. You know, this is a really weird example of a bad movie in terms of how we've covered the other bad movies, because embedded in this bad movie, which is a truly bad movie, is a tiny, small, really quite good movie.
Yes.
Which stars Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson.
Yes.
Do you agree?
I completely agree, and very easy to defend this plotline as well.
A lot of people will have seen Love Actually, and I'm sure will remember Emma and Alan Rickman. But what is going on in their plotline? And also, Sean, what do you think is so good about it?
So in this plotline, Emma is married to the boss of this aforementioned company, and that boss is Alan Rickman. In this aforementioned company, there's also a young, hot woman who seems to know that she's young and hot and has eyes for Alan Rickman, because isn't that what every young, hot woman wants to do in her company? Not just do her job and advance her career and help the team and be supportive. No, she wants to meddle in people's lives.
Just to dwell briefly on that woman named Mia, you know someone's bad news when they wear devil horns to a Christmas party.
Yes, I mean, it's like, babe, Halloween was like 2 months ago.
Yeah, yeah. So she is really scheming to get Alan, provocatively opening her legs at her desk. She's giving him come-hither eyes.
She's making him, you know, she's telling him she wants Christmas presents.
Yeah. And we start to see what's going on at the actual Christmas party, where Emma and poor Laura Linney are standing off to the side, observing as Emma's husband dances with the secretary. And Emma has a look in her eye that's like, I'm going to let this go on. I've been married to a long time for this man. I'm not going to raise any concerns, but I can see what's maybe brewing. There's a really quite finely observed scene of them in the bedroom, isn't there, after they get home from the office party.
Yes, this is the only plotline that feels like it has a beginning, middle, and an end, and a gestation period as well. So as they're getting ready for bed, and she's taking off her clothes, and, you know, we see her in her slip.
She's taking off her clothes, and also significantly complaining about how, quote, fat she is. Yet another fat joke in the film, the line being, all of my clothes were previously owned by Pavarotti.
Yeah, but we can make allowances for some fat jokes.
We can make allowances for some of them when they come in this insane onslaught of fat jokes across all the women. They become a bit problematic.
Pretending this is the only fat joke in the film, it would actually be quite fine. But she says, now, Brian, I want you to say an Emma Thompson voice.
Only if you respond in an Alan Rickman voice. Mia's quite good looking, isn't she?
Oh, really? You think so?
Darling, you know she is. Be careful there.
And that is the brilliance, the simple brilliance of that.
I'm not sure that our version of it quite conveyed that brilliance.
You see, if to do Alan Rickman, you have to just keep your teeth gritted. Like this. I mean, I haven't practiced, but you get the idea.
But Emma, I think, throughout this whole plot, I mean, she's connected to the Hugh Grant plot, she's connected to Liam Neeson for some reason. She basically, I think, gives us this rounded portrayal in this movie full of cardboard cartoons, right? Of a woman who is smart, sharp, raises her kids.
Yeah, responsible.
She's been in a long marriage.
Pragmatic.
She has longings. She doesn't allow them to dominate her life, but she and her husband have their little ups and downs. They have their tensions. She's playing some Joni Mitchell earlier in a previous scene, and he's making fun of her for liking Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, she's saying that if it weren't for Joni Mitchell, you know, she wouldn't be the woman she is today.
Well, she says, Joni Mitchell is the woman who made your cold English wife learn to feel.
Exactly.
So, you know, the thing is, Emma is wry. She has a whole, you know, spectrum of notes to play. And then they happen to be in Selfridges in the department store. And Alan Rickman, while Emma is away, is going to try and buy a necklace for his secretary. You know, and there's a lot of comedy here as Rowan Atkinson takes a long time to wrap the gift.
It's a lot of good comedy here, actually. This is the funny part, really.
Yeah, so Rickman thinks he's going to get caught out, but what makes this, I think, a cut above this plotline, Emma is legitimately so excited.
Yeah, so when they come home, so she doesn't see him purchase this necklace, even though she comes close, but as she's hanging up his coat, she feels in his pocket that there's a box, and in the box is a very expensive looking, very nice gold necklace with, it's a heart with a little tiny ruby in it. It's quite nice, actually, even for the early 2000s. And she feels genuinely excited because she's like, this man, after all these years, has made a gesture to show that he loves me.
And I love the way that Emma plays the kind of girlish enthusiasm. As they're opening the gift, she knows exactly which gift she wants to open before they take the kids off to their Christmas concert. And she rushes to open this package, thinking it's going to be this necklace, it's going to be this beautiful moment that will be a symbol of their, you know, their long marriage having a bit of a rekindling. And of course, oh, it's a Joni Mitchell CD. Oh, wonderful.
And she just excuses herself because of all the ice cream she's eaten.
And she's got to go and have a long scene, silent, except for her tears, in the bedroom.
Well, and Joni Mitchell, of course.
Now, here's the thing, Sean. Do you remember another grande dame actress, middle-aged, who had marital troubles that also related to Joni Mitchell?
Help me out here.
It's a same-sex relationship.
It's not Ennis Del Mar, is it? And Jack Twist?
No, no.
Okay, well, that's the only same-sex relationship I know.
Marriage is hard.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
Don't you remember?
No, I've only seen it once.
So when the kids are all right, Annette Bening also loves Joni Mitchell.
Oh.
It made me realize that, like, Annette Bening and Emma have a lot of similar qualities, and I started, like, imagining Emma in The Kids Are All Right as the Annette Bening character. It could have worked.
It could have worked, yeah, it could have worked.
They could probably do a lot of the same roles, yeah, back and forth.
Well, what's special about this scene amongst a film that basically rushes through 12 different plot lines is that it takes a good 2 minutes just in that room with Emma and her tears and Joni Mitchell and Emma kind of, like, shuffling, kind of pulling herself together, and just, like, allowing her to feel. I think it's brilliant.
Darling, could you just make sure the kids are ready to go?
All right. No,
I'll be back in a minute.
Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes real. I've looked at love that way.
Now, here's the thing, Sean. And remember, you're speaking to someone who is an Emma acolyte, yeah? I rushed to see this movie when it came out because of Emma's presence. I have to admit, that scene, when I saw it, left me pretty cold. And I feel like that is because I hated the rest of the movie so much that I felt like Emma had basically been exploited. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, had been kind of exploited to sell the rest of this crap that was all surrounding that scene. Because people would be like, oh, that scene with Emma Thompson, it was like a short film, like a one-act play in itself with all of her emotions and her crying. And I was just thinking, like, does Richard Curtis think that he's made a feminist film because he's given us this one scene with a rounded woman feeling, you know, emotions and sad, you know, on her own in this bedroom? And has Emma been complicit? I'm not sure I fully believe that, but can you talk me down
well,
from
she's
that
not,
position?
Well, she's not Ivanka Trump level of complicit here, okay? Let's just point that out.
I mean, of course, we all know that Emma cries like no one else, except maybe Julianne Moore. It's a different kind of crying.
It is. But the thing about this is that this is so good that it does kind of blinker you to the whole rest of the shit show that's happening around it.
You were getting genuinely moved.
Well, I actually had a cold, okay? So that's why I was sniffing. I wasn't getting upset or anything.
I think the other thing that Emma does better than anyone else in this film is, of course, that scene takes place about three quarters of the way through. There's a whole lot of other plot business to deal with. But whenever Emma recurs in the later scenes, like she pops up at the Christmas show, she runs into her brother, Hugh Grant, backstage, who's the Prime Minister. That plot line is mostly comic. It's like, oh, the Prime Minister has showed up at the school play. But Emma rushes and embraces him, and she's so emotionally overcome that her brother has taken time out to come there. And you just can sense that it's still the same night.
Yeah.
It's the same night that she has discovered that her husband may be cheating on her. And even in the midst of all this other ridiculous comedy that's going on, Emma is playing a real person.
Yeah.
And she does it so well in Sense and Sensibility. Yeah. She does it in Primary Colors. It's an emotional presence that few other actresses can match.
Yeah, and when she actually does confront her husband as well.
But again, not like aggressively.
No, and it's... Her delivery makes the writing sound good.
Tell me, if you were in my position, what would you do?
What position is that?
Imagine your husband bought a gold necklace and come Christmas gave it to somebody else.
Come on.
Would you wait around to find
Good
out
night.
If it... No. Happy Christmas. Would you wait around to find out if it's just a necklace or if it's sex and a necklace or if, worst of all, it's a necklace and... Love. Would you stay, knowing life would always be a little bit worse? Or would you cut and run?
God.
And all these notes are kind of played together in this kind of subtle, you know, gradations, one bouncing against the other.
While still being the jubilant mother so proud of her children for the Christmas pageant.
You totally know that Emma's character in this film is also like the president of the PTA.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that she never gets emotional in front of her children. You know, she always knows how to turn it on, turn it off, and put up a defense. And it's kind of like, this is what being a woman and a mother and a person...
And an adult.
And an adult is all about.
She's the only adult in this movie.
Yeah.
So basically, the whole rigmarole shebang ends with them all back at Heathrow Airport. Most romantic place in the world, Heathrow Airport.
Yeah, so Liam Neeson's child has been shot.
Okay, and Claudia Schiffer is there to deliver the eulogy.
Yeah.
Basically, we don't have to say what happens to everybody. Noticeably, Laura Linney doesn't get a conclusion, so we have no idea if she ever found a man who was able to put up with a woman who has an institutionalized brother. But how about the way that the Emma and Alan Rickman plot concludes?
Well, he's coming back from somewhere. It doesn't matter where, is it? And as he comes to the, you know, to the arrivals gate, he says hi to his kids and he embraces Emma in this way that speaks volumes about the silences that have happened between them or that have grown since this altercation.
And Emma gives a line that, it has to be said, Sean, whenever you and I have been having a dispute, if I said to you this line, you would not be happy. That line is, I'm fine. I'm fine.
I said that to you many times, haven't I?
So how do you read Emma's final line reading? She says, I'm fine. I'm fine. Let's go home.
Yeah. I read it as a person with responsibilities to other people.
Her children.
Her children, and the fact that her children have a father.
Mm.
You know, she's thinking, I am dealing with everything. I am dealing with the immediate first. That's tough to articulate.
So as much as you hate this movie, Love Actually, are you glad that it exists so that Emma is able to give us this mini masterclass in middle-class womanhood?
No, I would rather see this film non-existent, all of it, than have it exist just for her storyline.
If we could somehow extract her, though, can we learn anything about Emma's skills, Emma's talents, Emma's just general fabulousness by watching Love Actually. Can we transpose what she does in this movie to any of her other roles?
As you said earlier in the Sense and Sensibility episode, you know, she demonstrates so much feeling and meaning just by, like, her silences and her face and her physicality. You know, she is a true virtuoso in the craft of acting, and more so than anybody else in this film, anybody else, by country mile.
I mean, we've made the comparison in the past between Emma and Meryl Streep. We all know where my prejudices lie. Here's the thing I'll say about Emma. She doesn't have the range of someone like Meryl or even like Kate Blanchett. She rarely takes on roles that are all that different from herself in terms of accent or age or class.
Yeah.
But I do think that in the range of portraits that Emma Thompson has created, she goes deeper than so many people you see on screen.
Well, this is why she's like Cher, okay?
I'm ready to hear this.
No, because she, as we said before, Cher herself has said, I always play... I think it's fair to say that what Cher means when she says that is that all these roles are within my wheelhouse, within my range, within my abilities. I can be these characters. And Emma, in many ways, is kind of the same. Emma is no chameleon, like Meryl is.
She can go for really broad comedy, and the broad comedy can be cartoonish and fun, and but if she's playing naturalism, yeah, she's mostly playing smart, intelligent, middle-class British women.
Yeah, an Emma Thompson kind of role. But I don't think that's in any way a slight against her, absolutely not at all.
She plays that with, I think, such depth of feeling.
Yeah, it's like she has such strength, you know, in just tackling these.
And she can turn on a dime from the feelings of heartbreak to just having to be excited that her child is dressed as a papier-mâché lobster.
But you know for a fact that Emma Thompson has dealt with these real emotions in her life.
Yeah, you feel it. I mean, I'm sure she's having some sense memory there of Kenneth Branagh learning that he was coming home from the set of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and she found a lock of Helena Bonham Carter's hair in his coat and said, that looks vaguely like the woman who played my sister in Howard's End.
Oh my god, I forgot they were in Howard's End together.
Yeah, you know, Kenneth Branagh has a habit of casting women who've played Emma Thompson's sisters and co-stars and things, because his Ophelia was also Kate Winslet.
Did he have a thing with her?
Not that I know of. And actually, I think Emma and Kate have remained friends, because when Kate broke up with Sam Mendes, also because of cheating, the papers had it that Emma and Kate flew off to Puerto Vallarta or somewhere to, you know, to kind of help Kate deal with the with the pain. So, you know, Emma's a good sister to other spurned women.
Yeah. Kate's had a few rocky marriages, hasn't she?
Well, her current marriage is a bit rock and roll, if you ask me. But yes, that's a whole other matter. Now, Shawnee, we've gotten through Love Actually.
I never want to see this film ever again.
This is
never.
Probably the thing that we've done in our entire lives that is the most basic. In the week before Christmas, we watched Love Actually.
Can I be honest with you, Brian?
Yeah.
Watching this film and recording this podcast today has been hard. I'm not... You think I'm just saying this for a laugh. It's been hard. But I realized we were going through all those plot lines, talking about Love Actually, and nowhere near Emma. I felt pain. I did.
And was Emma enough to make you get through it?
It was, but I don't think I can do any promotion for this episode.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will just conclude by saying, at one point during the film, I don't even remember which plot line it was in relation to, Sean just screamed, "God, straight people are awful!" And that's probably a good note to end on.
Listen, to our straight listeners, please don't stop listening. There's so few of you as there is.
Okay, well, that was Love, actually. We have one more Emma Thompson film, which I suppose will serve as just a bit of a Christmas pudding at the end of this three-course meal.
No, this is the custard. This is the hot, juicy custard.
Yeah. If you have no idea what we're talking about, then you should check the tease, which is on our Twitter feed, at Broad Appeal Pod.
Yeah, and don't forget to follow us on our own individual Twitter handles. I'm at Sean McGovern X, and Brian is at BA Mullen Speaks.
We will be returning to basically the very beginning of Emma Thompson's career with the final episode of 2017 coming your way very soon.
Thank God.
Ho, ho, ho.